Welcome to another very special episode of Neurotransmissions. In our ongoing series from SFN.
Yeah, today we're going to switch gears a little bit and we're going to talk to two scientists. And they sort of study similar things. And what they do is they try to understand how we take all this information from the world and we integrate it in our nervous system. And then we generate behaviors.
Yeah, so I sat down with two of my old friends from the auditory field, David Schneider and Ross Williamson. First, we're going to hear from David. He's a postdoc at Duke, currently on the job market. Really, he's a real hot recruit. A lot of people fighting over him, but we're going to hear about his work studying inputs from motor cortex to the auditory cortex and why mice have this type of system. I'm joined by a very special guest right now, probably the person I've known the longest in neuroscience. He was my graduate school, I guess, brother? I don't know if we think about this as a family tree. David Schneider, PhD, joining us in the MPFI booth. How's it going, David?
Great. It's going great. Thanks. It's awesome to be on Neurotransmissions with you guys.
It's interesting to talk to you with two microphones between us. So I wanted to try to summarize a little bit about what your research covers, because it's kind of cool when you think about it in the abstract. It's also cool when you think about like how difficult and challenging the experiments are. But correct me if I'm wrong. One of the central questions about your research is understanding how inputs to auditory cortex are modulated by, or how auditory cortex is modulated by inputs from the motor system.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think, you know, my real theme of what I'm trying to do is to try to understand how the brain makes predictions is really how I would say what I do. And I'm particularly interested in how the brain makes predictions regarding hearing and sounds. And so the reason why I'm interested in how the motor system influences hearing and how it influences the auditory system is I think one of the most important predictions we make is something that I'm probably doing in my head right now, which is I'm predicting the sounds that my own movements make. And so this is like this very fundamental thing that we have where every time we, like if I'm learning how to play a musical instrument, for example, I have an idea for what sounds that my movements should make, and I'm constantly comparing what I hear with what I expect to hear.
Right.
And we think that this is something that's, it's critical for learning how to speak and learning how to play a musical instrument, and we think that it's accomplished in the brain by communication channels between motor systems in the brain that are important for making movements and the auditory system, which is important for hearing the sounds that the movements make.
So you've identified this microcircuit structure that involves both the motor cortex and the auditory cortex in the mouse.
Yeah, that's right.
So what is the type of behavior that a mouse does where the consequences of its movement would be important for trying to cancel that out or predict what's going on in the auditory system?
Yeah. So I think ethologically, there's probably a couple of situations where this is important. I think the most important one is mice are prey, and they're preyed on by predators. And so I think, you know, if we think about anytime I'm walking or a mouse is walking, our footsteps make noise, and mice walk through leafy fields and their footsteps are always making noise. And so I think an important thing that the mouse has to do is to be able to ignore all of the sounds that his own movements are making, like his footsteps while he's running through a field, so that he can tell if there's some predator that's in the distance, maybe stalking him, that's snapping a twig. You know, he wants to know when his footsteps snap a twig so that he can tell if some other twig snaps that's not locked to his footsteps. He knows, oh no, there's somebody else out there. I better run for cover.
Right, so it might be some kind of way to, you know, basically identify what am I doing versus what is the outside world doing. Like, how do I segregate myself from the outside world?
That's exactly right. Okay. And I think in mice also, one of their other beautiful behaviors that they do, which is, I think, understudied, is they also vocalize. So mice have these really beautiful vocalizations that are in the ultrasonic range. And it's unclear to what degree they have to use their hearing in order to learn those vocalizations. But I think it's probably true that they use their hearing in order to, you know, update and adapt their vocalizations during courtship.
So it seems like God is talking to us. So it seems like, you know, what you're describing in the auditory system, where you have the consequences of motion being accounted for in the auditory circuits, could be applied to a lot of different modalities. So, for instance, when you move around in the world, the visual scene changes.
Yeah, exactly.
So what are some of the similarities or differences between how motion influences auditory processing versus other modalities that might be important?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it's like, I think you make a great point. Like, if I move my eyes or I move my head, I don't think there's an earthquake happening because the whole auditory scene or the whole visual scene just changed.
Right.
I know that I just did it.
Right.
And I think the same is true, like, when I'm talking right now, I'm not afraid that there's some voice inside my head because I know that I just said these words. So I think the same general theme of the brain needing to be able to anticipate and expect what the sensory consequences of our own actions are going to be is got to be conserved across sensory modalities. You know, one thing though that's been really interesting recently in the mouse is that we find that in the auditory system, when an animal moves, in general, all auditory responses, neural responses to sounds, are just completely suppressed in the auditory system.
Okay.
But what's really interesting is that in the visual system of a mouse who's also moving, for instance, running on a treadmill or running through a maze, visual responses are enhanced. And so it's this interesting dichotomy where the brain seems to be saying, if I'm a mouse and I'm moving, let me enhance the responsiveness of one sensory modality and let me decrease the sensory responses of another modality. And so I think there's a lot of similarities from like an introspective point of view. Like, we always want to be able to understand what's going to happen when we make a movement. But I think that the way the brain handles different sensory modalities is probably very different.
Do we learn anything about the specific circuit, I don't know what the right way to explain, like, how these types of modulatory effects are instantiated in the brain? For instance, I think in your studies, correct me if I'm wrong, the motor inputs to the auditory cortex stimulate inhibitory neurons.
That's right.
And in the visual system, it must be different if, you know, motion or excitation causes visual neurons to be more responsive. So, Are the challenges that the visual system and the auditory system have just completely different, and that's accounted for in the circuits?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So yeah, you're right. So in the auditory system, the motor cortex kind of impinges on there and it synapses onto inhibitory neurons, and that in turn then suppresses the excitatory neurons. In the visual system, you have this extra synapse in between where what the motor input does to the visual system is it disinhibits the inhibitory neurons, which allows the excitatory neurons to actually become more excited. Mm-hmm. So there's one extra inhibitory node in that pathway. And so then I think the question is, like, why? The why question is the really important one. Like, why? What is the ecological reason why the brain would have come up with these different circuit architectures that are going to lead to different, different modulations of these different modalities? And my hand-wavy answer as to why the brain does that is, I'm thinking, if I'm a mouse and I'm running, I definitely don't want to run into that tree over there. So I better be able to detect vertical gratings, maybe even better than I would be if I'm standing still when I don't expect things to be running toward me. So I better enhance my visual representation. But at the same time, if I'm running and there's some other sound source that might be also moving, my ability to localize that in space using my hearing is probably diminished a little bit. And so this could be one way in which the brain is actually using some very smart way of reweighting sensory cues based on their reliability. So if I'm moving, sounds are less reliable based on for my ability to localize where they're coming from. But visual cues are really reliable for making sure I don't run into things. So that's kind of like, from an evolutionary perspective, that could be, or from a developmental perspective, that could be what the brain's doing.
So the basic behavior that you have the mice doing while you're observing these motor cortical effects in the auditory system is running. It's basically locomotion.
Yeah, running on a treadmill.
But you've talked to me about other ideas you have going forward about how you would extend this to more complex motor commands and stuff like that. What are some of the types of things you can do in the lab to sort of take this study further?
Yeah.
Without giving too much away, because...
so that not everyone who listens to this goes out and scoops me. I think, locomotion is a very simple and, in large part, kind of meaningless behavior. It's just one that we use in the lab a lot because we can study it. We can study head-fixed animals who are locomoting on a treadmill, and that really allows us to use a lot of the kind of circuit dissection tools that we like in the mouse. One of my goals is to figure out what are some more elaborate behaviors we can get mice to do while still having them head-fixed, maybe even. And so one of the ideas is having a mouse operate a joystick. So we can, we've been developing what we call acoustic virtual reality systems. So mice put their paw on a joystick and they move it around in kind of a two-dimensional joystick space, just like you would with an Atari controller. And the joystick itself doesn't make any noise at all, but it's hooked up to a computer. And so as the mouse is moving the joystick around, he's hearing sounds where effectively each point in kind of XY space that he moves the joystick through maps onto a unique sound. And so we can train mice then to move their joystick to some unique position in space which maps onto a unique sound. And I think that's a really more complex and meaningful type of behavior where the mouse is really using auditory information in order to update a motor plan. And I think that's the type of behavior where we can really try to understand, maybe at a more, if not ethological, at a more like really meaningfully complex level, mm-hmm. a cool behavior in which sensory and motor systems really need to interact in order to accomplish the behavior.
Are there any kind of diseases in humans or in any animal really that are, you know, part of their pathology is a dysfunction of these types of circuits where motor and auditory or motor and visual interactions are crucial?
Yeah, so that was one of the reasons why we really got into this in the first place, was that one of the major symptoms of diseases such as schizophrenia is auditory hallucinations, which are extremely voice-like in nature. And so people hear human voices even when there's nobody talking.
Right.
And so one of the kind of common theories out there, for which there's actually very little data to support, is that what this really is it's a dysfunction of this motor to auditory pathway that we know exists not just in mice, but also in mammals, including primates and humans. And so there's this direct connection from the motor cortex to the auditory cortex. We know that when schizophrenic patients are actively hallucinating, we've done experiments, not me personally, but colleagues have done these where people are in a scanner and they're doing fMRI during hallucinations and you see simultaneous activation of both motor and auditory cortices. And so one thing we think is maybe this pathway is a little bit messed up in these people, and mm-hmm. The motor to auditory pathway starts getting activated even when they're not speaking, maybe when they're just kind of like internally thinking, but their auditory system gets activated in a way that they think they're actually hearing something. So yeah, one of the real motivations for studying this in the mouse is to say, let's figure out how it works normally, and then maybe we can even use mouse models of schizophrenia to say, is there any dysfunction in this pathway that could account for some of the differences that we see, you know, in humans mm-hmm. with schizophrenia.
All right, so enough about you.
Enough about me. Let's talk about you.
No, let's talk about SFN. So yeah. How has SFN been? Like, what have you seen here that has totally blown your mind or just totally disappointed you?
Well, I saw the poster that scooped me, so that was always fun.
So what is scooping for the
What is
person?
Scooping? Oh, yeah. I saw a poster of some people who had a very similar finding to me and have already published it.
Okay.
Or are about to publish it. But the truth is actually I'm lying about that. So I'm not lying that I saw that poster. I really did see it. But I'm actually really excited that they found it, because I think this idea of scooping is one that I don't really subscribe to. I think the idea of having other people who are pursuing the same research as you from a slightly different angle and finding very similar findings to you is extremely affirmative. It's like affirming.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm always worried when I'm doing my science that I found something that nobody's reported before, and the only reason I'm finding it is because I did something terribly wrong.
Right.
And so if somebody else has a finding that looks, you know, both on the surface and when you really start to dig through it, to be the same thing, I'm really excited. And I think there's enough room for us in science. We don't know, I feel like we know less than 1% about all the cool things that the brain is doing. There's enough room for us to, you know, diverge that I'm always excited when somebody does something similar to me.
So that's a good answer, because it's both exciting and disappointing.
Yeah, it's got both. It's got a little bit of everything.
It's a perfect human drama. Shakespeare would have loved it.
What else did I see that was exciting? Boy. You know,
it's a nice thing. You know, we went out to dinner with our friend Anna Gret, who we haven't seen in a while. Like, it's nice to like come to these meetings and see people that you really... You used to see them all the time, but now these are really your only opportunities to see those people. So that's one thing that's pretty cool. It's like a way to keep in touch with, you know, parts of your scientific life that...
I think so. Here's my other thing. I came to SFN and I was kind of expecting that I wasn't going to see anything that was going to blow my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of always do that. And I think part of the reason is that it's really hard. It's such a massive conference that it's really hard to like ever just say like, okay, I'm going to engage myself with this person. I don't know what they do, but I'm going to engage myself enough to really understand why what they're doing is super meaningful. But one thing that I've done in this conference is gone back to friends like Anna Gret and other colleagues who I've known from the past, where it's like, I have a vested interest in really learning what they're doing. And as soon as I actually devote myself to a poster, to really getting the full walkthrough of it, I am amazed at the cool progress that people are making and understanding, like, really crazy things that I've never even thought about studying.
Yeah.
So to me, it's actually been uplifting.
Right.
To see that I think there is amazing science going on, and people are doing really profound and amazing things where they're layering techniques that I didn't even think were possible together in behaving animals to study things that I would have never even thought about studying.
Yeah, I mean, and hopefully we're going to get Anna Gritt on the show to talk about her social neuroscience research. You sent something to me the other day that I thought was kind of profound, which was, if you think about this meeting, there's like 30,000 people here. They're all presenting their work. Maybe not 30,000 posters or something. Let's call it 20,000. Just a whole bunch of posters. And I'm not going to go as negative as you went, but...
I was hoping you weren't going to quote me on that.
No, I'm not going to quote
you. You can.
I'm going to sugarcoat your message. For better or for worse, you know, SFN to some... And we can cut this if this is too negative. It kind of represents essentially 30,000 human years of research every year.
Yeah.
Like, if you think about the amount of time people put into the projects that they're presenting, it takes them about a year from one SFN to the next in order to put that research forward. And it's sometimes, when you look at it at that scale, it's so incremental, it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of progress. You would think that with 30,000 human years of work, we would solve the brain almost. But, like, that is not the case. There's always something new. And I think what's interesting about what you just said is that, you know, if you go to any individual poster and really get into the details of what they did and are super impressed by it, a lot of the really interesting stuff is happening on small incremental scales that are super important.
Yeah.
So it emphasizes that in science, like, you know, progress isn't just like big solutions about where consciousness comes from or how, you know, animals do behaviors and stuff. It's like really getting down into the minutiae. And yeah.
So I did. You quoted me accurately. What I said was really that sometimes SFN can be depressing because you think about the number of human years that went into each SFN, and, you know, 10 years of SFN represents something like 300,000 human years of research.
Right, it's crazy.
And we haven't solved the brain yet. But, and you're spot on. Once we take the time to invest in going to a poster, what you realize is that it really is like the incremental science is profound in and of itself. And just because we haven't solved the brain, or just because we haven't cured a disease, doesn't mean that we haven't made profound insights into basic and foundational mechanisms that are important for neurobiology.
That are going to keep building on
exactly. And we know that that's how science works. And so I think, you know,
it's all about perspective.
It's about perspective.
Yeah.
And I think SFN, for me, this year has kind of given me the full range of perspectives, where I've kind of gone through, you know, being inundated because there's just way too much for me to even start to absorb, to also just deciding that I'm just going to go and focus on a poster and really learn about it and being really impressed with what I saw.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of coming up on the end of your postdoc. You're at the stage where you're figuring out where you're going to end up with your next gig as a faculty member. You're on the job market actively. What is that? You're the first person we've ever had on the show that's at that specific stage of their career.
Yeah.
That for someone like me who's sort of at the beginning of their postdoc is a little bit, seems super daunting. Like, how is it going for you? I mean, is it super stressful? Is it fun?
It
seems
both.
Like you're meeting a lot of new people and
it's amazing.
Getting your work out there.
It is one of the, it's both. So it's super stressful. It's super fun. I think here's the thing that I didn't realize was going on the job market kind of means stopping being a postdoc for a little bit. I haven't done experiments for a while because I've been busy writing a research statement, I've been busy writing applications, and I've been busy visiting universities. And that's hard. It's really hard to kind of stop having the progress that you're used to making as a postdoc.
Right.
It's extremely exciting. I think going to visit a university and having 2 days of back-to-back interviews, meeting with 20 different faculty and giving a chalk talk and giving a seminar is awesome. And you get to learn about things you have never thought about in your life. But it's also stressful because you think, like, everyone's judging you at the same time, constantly. But it's fun. I mean, because the truth is I'm there and I'm evaluating these people as well. And every single person I've met, I've left that meeting saying, wow, I had not thought about what they've done before, but I think it's really awesome.
That's
so
cool.
In some ways, it's really, yeah, really motivating. I think when you think about it, it seems like it's going to be stressful. But when you actually go through it, it's way more fun than it is scary or stressful. It's actually an extremely enjoyable experience.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, best of luck. Thanks for sitting down and talking about your work today, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been awesome.
Good luck.
Oh, so that's why mice have that type of system.
Exactly.
That's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. So, Joe, who's up next?
This is Ross Williamson. He's a postdoc at Harvard. He also studies the role of auditory processing during behavior, and we're going to hear about some of his circuit work that he's been working on lately.
Cool.
So we're back on the floor at San Diego Society for Neuroscience 2016, joined by a good friend of mine, Ross Williamson. He's a postdoc at Harvard Medical School in the lab of Dan Pauly at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, based on what I'm reading off of his badge. So Ross, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, no worries. This is awesome.
You are a unique friend in my life because we met by going to conferences. We had no like overlap in grad school or anything, but
yep.
I saw you enough and found you funny enough to hang out with you every time I see you at
my
SFN
work was
or
awesome
Cosine.
Enough.
Yeah, exactly. That was a big part of it. So tell us a little bit about what you're up to in your postdoc. You've been working in the auditory system since grad school.
Yep.
But you have a new take on how to study that. You're formerly a computational guy.
Yep.
And so, you're now doing more experimental stuff. So what is the type of circuit that you're interested in?
So broadly, I'm interested in... I often make the joke that I want to try and turn the auditory cortex into the cochlear nucleus. The cochlear nucleus, for decades now, people have been able to identify kind of a functional taxonomy. The cochlear nucleus is 15, 20 different cell types, each with their own individual physiological characteristics. And people have been able to relate that to behavior and function. And at the level of the cortex, it seems that for the last 20 years, we've really only had kind of blunt tools at our disposal, things like layer and spike width, in order to try and achieve specificity, in order to try and ascribe function to circuits. So what I really want to try and do is move towards identifying a functional taxonomy in the auditory cortex. And the way that I want to try and do that is by using projection neurons. And that's largely because these are indivisible classes of cells sitting in the cortex. And they're indivisible because they have unique morphology. They have unique synaptic properties. And so they're explicitly marked as a specific type. So broadly, I'm interested in two primary classes of projection neurons. One sitting in layer 5 that goes to the inferior colliculus. These are large pyramidal tract cells, intrinsic bursting cells in layer 5 that are responsible for transmitting information subcortically. And corticothalamic cells, which sit in layer 6. And they're responsible for sending information to the thalamus, but they're also intimately involved in setting the gain for the entire cortical column. So these are two kind of classes of projection neurons that are responsible for two very, very different aspects of cortical processing.
And they're also kind of interesting in the sense that in the auditory system, we think about auditory information as flowing kind of from the ear to the cortex.
Yes.
In a broad sense. These are both types of projections of neurons from the cortex back down to lower-level auditory
exactly,
regions.
Exactly. And one of the really interesting things, I think, is that... So I say cortical collicular cells. These are cells in layer 5 that project to the inferior colliculus. But these cells also have collateral axons that they drop collaterals to multiple other areas all the way through the auditory system. So these same cortical neurons will drop collaterals all the way down to the level of the cochlear nucleus, ventral cochlear nucleus, as well as the superior olive. So it's kind of this, they're in this unique... They have this unique property of being able to send feedback signals to subcortical stations, and then that feedback signal can then be used to adjust cortical representations. So it kind of ties into this notion, I think, of behavioral relevance. If you're listening to a sound or you're engaged in a task where something is important, then these neurons have the ability to send that information to subcortical stations so that it then goes back up and becomes involved in processing
like
at the level of the cortex.
A feedback loop that could be filtering out like interesting information for whatever the animal might be doing. And so how do you, you have a really interesting behavioral paradigm that you guys developed in the Pauly lab. And I know from seeing you talk before before you got into recording from these cortical projection neurons, you were recording in the auditory thalamus during behavior. So talk a little bit about that. Like, what was the behavior that you were having the mice do?
So the lab that I'm in just now has a history of using what we like to call foraging tasks. And these are closed loop behaviors, which are very interesting to study. So the task that I worked on was, we had an animal running around, a mouse running around on a circular track, essentially. And the idea with these closed loop foraging tasks is that you want to guide the animal to an invisible target via some modulation of the sensory environment. So in the past, my advisor and others have varied things like click rate of the repeat rate of a tone, for example. Mm-hmm. So you might imagine that you can set a target in this large two-dimensional environment, and as the animal gets closer to the target, the click rate gets faster and faster and faster.
It's like hot cold.
Exactly, it's exactly like the hot and cold type paradigm game that you played as a kid, and this becomes really interesting to study at the level of the thalamus, especially. So I kind of had a slight variant on that task where the animal just was tasked with identifying when an interval became short. So he would be running around the environment, hearing these. In fact, my task was multi-sensory, which was why it was a little more complicated. So he would be listening to clicks that were separated by a long interval, and he would also be seeing flashes that were separated by a long interval. And if he was being trained on the auditory version of the task, he would get a reward if he stopped at a location where those long intervals became short, or the other way around if he was trained on the visual task.
So is there a multi-sensory component to the responses in the thalamus? Do you see that like the visual version of the task can modulate auditory neurons?
So that's something that we were interested in looking at, but no, we weren't really able to find any visual responses in the thalamus, so to speak.
So that means that the thalamus is then like specifically dedicated to the auditory version.
Yeah, exactly. But what's particularly nice about the mouse thalamus is that we were able to record from the LGN, the visual thalamus, and the auditory thalamus simultaneously. So I used 4 shank neuron exosilicon probes so that we could record from both areas simultaneously and look at potential interactions. But what was really interesting to us was that there are different modulatory factors at play when an animal engages in a task like this. So something that myself and others have been increasingly interested in these days is locomotion as a modulatory factor.
We had David Schneider on the podcast yesterday, and he talked a little bit about interactions between the motor system and the auditory system.
Yes,
is that
exactly
kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So David has done some quite beautiful, elegant work showing interactions between the motor cortex and the auditory cortex. And it's then an obvious question is to ask whether or not this same kind of locomotion suppression, whether or not that's present at other stages in the auditory pathway. I mean, one of the nice things that David showed was that this corally discharge signal, there's certainly a cortical locus to it, but it doesn't explain everything. And in some sense, you might imagine that some of this locomotion effect may just be due to mechanical issues at the level of the inner ear, for example. So one of the things that we were interested in is looking within our thalamic recordings to see whether or not there was a locomotion effect. And the interesting thing is that, as with the visual cortex versus auditory cortex difference, there are also differences at the level of the thalamus. So when you look in the auditory thalamus, you see very, very strong suppression, just like you do in the auditory cortex, but in the LGN we didn't observe any difference in firing rate.
Oh, so that's important because the LGN is sort of the visual version of the thalamus.
Yes, so exactly. So in the visual thalamus, locomotion really didn't have an effect, and that's broadly been seen by a bunch of other labs. So Chris Neal and Michael Stryker have the original finding of the locomotion enhancement that's typically seen in the visual cortex.
So do you have a take on why the auditory system is specifically suppressed by locomotion, but the visual system has, at least at the level of the cortex, an enhancement of the response?
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, the answer that David would probably give is just to do with self-generated sounds. I mean, this kind of goes back to some of the brilliant work of Eliades and Wang, and the idea that as I'm speaking, for example, I want to suppress responses to my own vocalizations because they're irrelevant to me because I'm speaking them.
Right.
And that's generally the kind of idea that people typically use with why the locomotion effect, locomotion suppression is important in the auditory cortex. And I mean, one of the things I think that was interesting from our perspective is that you can, we try to fit some stimulus decoding models. So we actually tried to finish off the study by trying to understand whether or not locomotion was important for being able to solve the task. And one thing that you can see, and this has been shown in the visual system as well, that the visual enhancement that you see when animals run can give you an increased performance in being able to identify stimuli. So essentially, when you're running, you can identify visual stimuli better. The opposite is true in the auditory system. So when you are running, you are not able to identify auditory stimuli.
So if I'm looking for my friend in a crowd, I should like run around like a madman, basically.
No, it's the opposite. I'm sorry. If you want to see him, yes.
Yeah,
To hear him, you're better to stop.
Stay still.
Yeah, exactly,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay, cool. So now you're working on categorizing different types of cortical cells that project to different regions subcortically.
Exactly.
What are some of the techniques that you use to try to answer these questions?
Yeah, so I'm using some advances in optogenetics. I'm using a strategy which Tony Zader originally came up with called PIMP. So we're using optogenetics to phototag neurons. I'm doing it antidromically, and what I mean by that is I'll take a... Well, in order to characterize layer 6, these cortical thalamic cells, we use a transgenic mouse line. And this is a transgenic mouse line that has been used by researchers in the visual system. It's called the NTSR1 Cre line. And that just means that Cre recombinase is present in all layer 6 cortical thalamic cells. So that means that we can use a floxed virus and we can express channel rhodopsin in just these cells. I can then implant an optic fiber into the thalamus, and I can shine light directly on the axon terminals. And
so that will stimulate the cells with an antidromic...
Yes, exactly. So that will send an antidromic spike up the axon, and it will also cause a bunch of indirect activity, because when the antidromic spike comes up, you'll get a bunch of synaptic transmission in the local cortical circuit. But this allows us, this gives us a way to identify uniquely these cells. So I record from the auditory cortex with a laminar, a probe that spans multiple layers, that's got quite high density. So I can cover these multiple layers in the cortex, record extracellularly, fire an antidromic spike, and that gives me the power to say, this particular neuron is a projection neuron. And I can then separate that from everything that surrounds it and compare the response properties, for example, of the projection neuron to every other neuron in layer 5 that I've identified, or every other neuron that I've identified as having a fast spiking waveform.
So you do this in all the different types of projection patterns you want to see. You can do it in the thalamus, you can do it in the inferior colliculus. And then do you have the animal doing these types of tasks while you're recording from these cells? Or what is the type of thing you're trying to characterize? What are the properties of these cells that you want to characterize?
So like I was saying, these projection neurons kind of form indivisible classes because they have unique morphology. So the first part of what I was interested in was just characterizing these projection neurons and trying to understand what kind of information they were able to carry. And perhaps unsurprisingly, a lot of the response properties and characterization of these neurons corresponds directly almost to the morphology. So to use the cortical collicular cells as an example, these are very thickly tufted cells that receive very broad excitation directly from the thalamus. And so if you just play pure tones to the neuron and compute its frequency response area, you find that it is tuned very, very broadly. And that's kind of reflective of its morphology.
So this is like sort of a functional biophysical assessment of what these cells
are
designed to do.
And we can make things a little more advanced. So I also looked at the notion of lifetime sparseness and stimulus selectivity. So moving away from the simple auditory characterization, we came up with a method to present banks of completely random stimuli to the neurons so that you could then look at stimulus selectivity on a kind of grander scale. And a similar result holds that with these neurons that have these broad excitation patterns, they also respond to more stimuli, so they're not particularly selective. And this kind of ties in with what I was saying earlier, that these cortical collicular cells seem to be in this prime position to be able to send robust feedback signals all the way down to the level of the brainstem. Cortical thalamic cells, on the other hand, have very, very different response properties. They're typically a lot more selective. They respond to less stimuli, essentially.
So if you can characterize these different properties of these cells, you can start to form maybe a hypothesis about their importance in different types of behaviors.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's our future goals. We really want to move on to trying to understand how these projection neurons engage in behavior. And what's particularly interesting is that their connectivity within the cortical circuits is very, very different. So I get with these cortical thalamic cells have a lot of interactions with the fast spiking neurons in layer 6. In the visual system, so much so that if you activate these layer 6 cells, you can shut down the visual cortex completely. These layer 5 cells, on the other hand, that project to the colliculus, tend to just talk amongst themselves. So it's going to be absolutely fascinating to try and find out how they're active during behavior and whether or not any of the kind of behavioral relevant signals are sent subcortically, or how the layer 6 cortical thalamic can act to gate behavioral information within the cortex.
That's really cool.
And I think ultimately, to tie it back in with these foraging tasks, we now have access to like a wonderful virtual reality setup. Chris Harvey developed this amazing technology in order to record from a head fixed mouse running on a ball while he's engaged in a virtual environment. By utilizing that kind of setup, we can start to think about using techniques like two-photon microscopy to be able to record from entire populations of these projection neurons, which we can identify in transgenic animals.
Yeah.
So we can really try and understand at the population level how these genetically identified cell types are able to be engaged in these complex behavioral tasks.
That's really cool. So you have like a nice set of hypothesis building at this stage, and that just opens up a whole new set of experiments you can do down the line with.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool.
And I mean, to try and put it in a bigger perspective, I think the whole notion of being able to identify a functional taxonomy in the auditory cortex is somewhat of a grandiose claim, but it essentially comes from our ability to just explain variability within our data sets.
Right.
So if you were a two-photon imager, for example, and you recorded from 300 cells in layer 2-3, and you were able to then taxonomize those and say, 20% of these cells are active during a particular point in a task, another 20% are active here, another 20% are active here, then the immediate question is, well, what's so special about these cells, you know?
Right.
It seems somewhat to just isolate them in terms of layer or spike width, I would argue, is not enough if you really want to understand
what they're doing
and how to ascribe function to the circuitry.
Exactly.
And I think that being able to get to achieve cell type specificity at the level of where the information goes is a step in the right direction towards really understanding how the cortex functions.
So I have a completely unrelated question, so you did your graduate work in the UK.
Yes.
You came to the States to do your postdoc. What's it like doing research in another country? Do you miss home? For somebody who grew up in the States, there's a lot of great research opportunities in Europe. And, you know, I think there's maybe a hesitation to jump over the ocean because of, you know, just the uncertainty and the stress of going to a new place. But how has that been for you coming to?
Do you know something?
Country?
I have absolutely loved it. I mean, I completely agree. There's wonderful, wonderful research being carried out all around the world. For me, it's just been a great opportunity. I took the leap. Like you say, I was kind of more of an applied mathematician. I studied theoretical neuroscience for my PhD, and I got a hankering to learn how to gather my own data because I wanted to test my own hypotheses, and I wanted to eventually down the road have my own lab where I can gather data and I can construct exciting models that can explain that data. I haven't regretted it at all. It's been a fantastic opportunity, especially in the US. The NIH and the NSF provide a lot of money for science, and we have access to a lot of great tools with which to carry out our research. So
cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for sitting down and talking today, man.
Sure, no worries.
Good to see you. Let's go get a beer.
Yes, all very right. Much so.
What a great set of interviews, Joe. This is really interesting kind of work.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that I was able to track down two of my friends, both working in similar fields, both doing really cool complementary research, and makes for a nice cohesive podcast episode.
After being your friend, their research is the second best thing about them.
Aww.
All right, so thank you everybody very much for listening. We want to thank everybody in the communications department for helping us record this, for helping us record it all on site at SFN as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, follow us at Neuro Podcast on Twitter, and bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.